As we look at the chapter that we read a little part of, Hebrews 11, if you're familiar with it, it gives us these little summaries of the life of lots of different people from the Old Testament. We start with Adam and Eve's son Abel, and we go all the way through to the people the author lists right at the end, but he doesn't quite have time to tell us about Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, and David, and Samuel, and the prophets. But this chapter isn't just a history lesson, is it? It's not just a case of learning the facts, the dates, whatever else it is history teachers teach. Because the book of Hebrews was written to Jewish Christians who were suffering trials because of their faith. And it was written specifically to help them live through those trials, to encourage them to trust in God while they walk by faith. So as we begin to focus on our little section of the passage, I hope you notice that as we read about Moses, his family, we see people who made choices. Our lives are full of choices, aren't they? Maybe in the 21st century we have more choices than people who went before us. Some make very little difference. Do you want marmalade or jam on your toast for breakfast? Doesn't really matter. But others are much more serious. Are you going to trust God in this situation you're facing, even when the outcome of trusting God and obeying him is going to be difficult, when you might lose a friend for it, when you might be left out by everyone else at school or university or work, when you might lose your job, your standard of living, your home, when you might suffer physical violence or imprisonment or even worse. Now, some of that might sound far-fetched for us sitting comfortably in Cheshire here this evening, but some of us will have known those consequences. And Christians all around the world today are having to make those choices and having to face the same consequences. And in the near or distant future, so might you or I. So Moses and his family made choices that were hard to make, that had very real consequences. So what can we learn from them? And more importantly, what can we learn about the God that they trusted and obeyed, the same God that you or I can trust today in our difficult decisions? You know, the Bible has, we call them stories, don't we? Many years ago, I went to a conference on children's work, and one of the speakers said, try not to use the word stories, because when children hear that, they think it's just something made up, like all the other stories I read. When we call them Bible stories, sometimes we forget that this is about real people like you and me, real people with emotions and fears and other things that make us human. And if we forget that they were real people, we lose out because we sort of imagine they were like superheroes who found it very easy and there's nothing really for us to learn. But they were ordinary people like you or like me. And so we can learn how we can live through similar trials. Because even though thousands of years might separate us, what unites us is that we trust in the same God. So let's see how Moses and his family lived this life of faith being defined in the words we have at the beginning of this chapter, being sure of what we hope for and being certain of what we do not see. We've got three little episodes to look at through the life of Moses. We're going to look at disobedience, we're going to look at disgrace, and we're going to look at death. So in verse 23, our first little episode, we learn about Moses' parents, Amram and Jochebed. We learn about disobedience when breaking the law was the only option. So it says, by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So if you're not familiar with that episode, the people of Israel had ended up living in Egypt. They'd come, Jacob and his brothers with Joseph had come down to live in Egypt to escape the famine. And after hundreds of years, their numbers had grown. They hadn't intermingled and integrated into the Egyptian society. And the king of Egypt began to fear. There's all these people here. They're not really part of us. And if an invading army comes, then they may join the enemy and fight against us. What can we do to diminish the risk of that? What can we do? Let's order that all the baby boys have to be thrown into the river Nile. Presumably all the baby girls would then have to marry into Egyptian families and integrate. So that was the law. The midwives resisted, and then Moses' family had a little baby boy, Moses, and they weren't going to throw him into the River Nile. So instead, they put him in the little basket with tar on. They made it waterproof. He was found by Pharaoh's daughter. His big sister was looking on when this happened, and Moses was saved. Moses was going to be taken into the palace, but in the meantime, his big sister went and bravely said, "Would you like me to go and get one of the Hebrew women to feed this baby for you?" And so Moses stayed at home till he was weaned and then went into Pharaoh's palace. So normally Christians are required to respect and keep the law, aren't we? Even if we disagree with it. We have been going through Hebrews 11 in Wheelers. That's the first reason I came to this passage, and just thought I would take one episode I talked about and then add a little bit more on. But when I was teaching the Wheelers, they were a little bit shocked when I told them how I'd been to the shop and forgot my wallet. And so I spend a bit of money in this shop already. I'll just take this without paying. And then I was late for Wheelers, so I did 80 miles an hour down the bypass. They said, "You'll be caught by the police." They said, "Well, I was." And then I punched him on the nose because he was telling me off. I have to say, just to be 100% clear, that never happened. That was just an illustration. But we have to obey the laws. We have to obey the traffic laws, even when we're late. We have to pay our taxes, even if we don't want to, even if we disagree with what the government is going to spend it on. And Paul, in Romans chapter 3, he gives us a number of reasons why we should obey the law. He says God has established governments, and to rebel against the government is to rebel against what God has instituted. He said, only those who are doing wrong need to fear the rulers. Governments are God's servants for our good, he writes, and then they're God's servants to punish those who do wrong. And so we have to submit, not just to avoid getting punished, but also for our conscience sake. And those are good principles almost all the time. But we know that sometimes, although they have a power that's given by God's providence, governments themselves rebel against God. Instead of using authority for our good, they use their authority for evil. We see that in the news, don't we, day by day. So, and there are times when we as Christians have to appeal to a higher authority than a corrupt and wicked man. So Jochebed didn't throw off the law completely. She said, he didn't say, "Right, I don't have to obey any laws at all." She broke the law in a lovely sort of ironic way, in the least way possible. She did put Moses into the River Nile. He just had this little waterproof boat instead to save him. So we might ask, when is it okay to break the law? Well, we've got a great illustration in the book of Acts. The apostles have been arrested for preaching about Jesus. An angel sets them free and specifically says, "Go and tell people about this. Go and stand in the temple again." And of course, the rulers don't like that. He gave you strict orders not to teach in this name, but now you've filled Jerusalem with your teaching. And Peter and the apostles reply, "We must obey God rather than human beings." And that's a great principle, isn't it? When it comes to it, is what I'm doing in obeying the law obeying God, or is it obeying a human being who's going against God's law? In verse 23, we read that Moses' parents were not afraid of the king's edict. That doesn't mean they were the sort of emotionless robots that couldn't know or experience fear. When I was a boy, one of the cartoons we used to watch was called Batfink. I don't know if there's anybody who remembers Batfink. Lots of blank faces. Oh, there's a couple over here. So Batfink was a bat, you might imagine, a superhero bat. And he had this little catchphrase. It was the sort of thing that's more or less the same story every time. But his catchphrase, "Your bullets cannot harm me. My wings are like a shield of steel." And he'd wrap his wings around himself. The baddies would shoot at them and the bullets would just bounce off, and then the baddies would get their comeuppance. But Moses' parents were not like that. They weren't able to look at the consequences of breaking the law and say, "Okay, bring it on, see if we care." The risk of punishment was very real for them, but they chose to trust God. They chose to fear disobeying God's righteous laws instead of man's wicked laws. So for Moses' parents, Jochebed and Amram, They show that obeying God is the only way when obeying God's laws, so when obeying man's laws, is to go against God's laws, whatever the consequences might be. But in God's providence and grace, their faith was rewarded. Moses had been in great danger. He ends up living in the only safe place for a Jewish boy in Egypt, in Pharaoh's palace. And better still, his parents are able to look after him until he's weaned, probably later than is common in the West, maybe 3 or 4 years old. And in that time, they're able to pass on to him the knowledge of God and God's promises that would go deep into his being for later years. Maybe for us, that time when we have to disobey the law will be in our work. Maybe something you have been asked to be involved in and you can't do that. Maybe you're a teacher and you're asked to teach something that goes against God's laws. Maybe it's at school. But God honours here. We see that God honoured not just Moses' parents, he honoured the midwives who also refused to put the babies into the River Nile. And God will honour us even when others might not. So let's look at our second point. Moses is grown up now. Moses at 40, we're in verses 24 onwards. And when choosing disgrace is the best option. So by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. So Moses is grown up, goes out to see his own people. He sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, an Israelite. He looks this way, he looks that way. He kills the Egyptian and hides his body in the sand. The next day he goes out again, sees two Hebrews fighting and remonstrates with them. What are you doing? And then the man says, well, are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? Pharaoh gets to hear of this and Moses has to flee because Pharaoh wants to kill Moses. Off he goes, ends up living in the wilderness, ends up joining himself to a family and ends up marrying one of the daughters there. So if I was teaching this passage to children, I might borrow the scales from home. We've got the scales where you put the weights on the one side and the thing you want to weigh on the other side. And the beauty of those scales is that you can easily see which side weighs the most. And that's really what we find Moses doing here. He's weighing up two options, two choices, two ways of life. So on the one hand, he's got choosing to be ill-treated with the people of God. Is that better or worse than enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin? He's got disgrace for the sake of Christ. On the other hand, he's got the treasures of Egypt. On the one hand, he's got leaving Egypt. Is that better or the king's anger? He perseveres because he sees him who is invisible. So when we think about all the things on the Pharaoh-Egypt side that Moses has to weigh up, what do they have in common? Well, the first thing they have in common is they're temporary. Read about the fleeting pleasures of sin. You know, sin is often but not always pleasurable, but the pleasure doesn't last, does it? And then we need more sin to sustain that pleasure. And then sometimes there's a law of diminishing returns that we need to do more and more to get the same pleasure as time goes on because we get less and less from it. Likewise, the treasures of Egypt could only belong to Moses in this life. The pharaohs were buried with their treasures, weren't they? At least some of them, supposedly to accompany them to the afterlife. All the treasures they'd need to still enjoy luxurious living in the world to come. But that was merely wishful thinking. Where are those treasures now? They've either been stolen by grave robbers or they've been stolen by grave robbers called archaeologists and they're in a museum. We'll weigh up all the things on the people of God's side. What do they have in common? Well, it might surprise you that all the disadvantages are temporary too. The ill treatment is temporary. The disgrace is temporary. The king's anger is temporary. Even if those things ended in death, they cannot affect Moses beyond the grave. And the second thing about them is they're bearable. They might not be pleasant, with God's grace and God's provision and God's protection, Moses lived through them and came out the other side because his eyes were on someone who can't be seen, him who is invisible, but someone who can be known. So I want us to see how deliberate Moses was in what he did. Look at the verbs, the doing words used about him. By faith, Moses, when he had grown, he refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. So the example of Moses is a man who by faith does things, doesn't he? He chooses to do things. By faith, he refuses. By faith, he chooses. By faith, he chooses disgrace for the sake of Christ. By faith, he leaves Egypt rather than enjoy the temporary pleasures of sin. If you were asked to define faith, we might sort of talk about things we believe. That is part of faith, isn't it? We might focus on our emotions. But the faith we're reading about in Hebrews 11 is much more than that. True faith, like Moses, weighs things up. True faith calculates. Because when life is difficult, emotions aren't going to carry us through. But choosing to have faith in God and his promises will. There are some people who have to suffer with the people of God. They didn't choose that path, others did for them. And that's not wrong. That's just the way things have worked out in their lives. But Moses shows us there are times when we shouldn't hide who we are. We need to identify as belonging to Christ, as being one of the people of God. And that can be a costly choice. When Moses makes his choice, he leaves the treasures of Egypt. He leaves being part of the ruling elite of the day. He leaves being in the most advanced civilization in the world at that time. And he knows he isn't going to be worse off. He was looking ahead to his reward. All the other things were lesser. And so he could touch and see the treasures of Egypt, but holding on to them meant holding on to a life of sin. And so he leaves them behind where moth and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. And Moses stores up for himself treasure somewhere else. Where? In heaven. Remember Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. Moses is content to leave his treasure there until he's looking ahead to his reward is finished and he receives the reward and that welcome that Jesus described, well done and good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. So instead of Moses being a prince in Egypt, what do we find him doing? We find him leaving the luxury of the palace, leaving all the servants, leaving his status behind. In effect, he becomes a refugee. There are people who leave their native country looking for a better life, aren't they? So-called economic migrants. They don't always find it. But they leave their families, their friends, certainty, familiarity, the uncertain hope of a better future somewhere else. But Moses is a sort of reverse economic migrant. In the eyes of the world, he's throwing away the best of this life for something worse. Off he goes into the unknown, away from the well-watered farmland of the River Nile Delta, into Midian, to what's later described as the wilderness. We don't know what Moses imagined he would be doing, or where he'd end up, or how he thought he would manage to get by to feed and clothe himself. We find him becoming a shepherd as he joins Jethro's family business and becomes part of Jethro's family by marrying one of the daughters. God provides for his people. But in a sort of extension of the disgrace he had by apparently foolishly leaving Pharaoh's palace for who knew what, we find him becoming a shepherd. If you're familiar with the story in Genesis, you might remember how when hundreds of years before Jacob and his family had come to join Joseph, Joseph was by this time the prime minister. Joseph told them this. He said, when Pharaoh calls and asks you what's your occupation, you should answer, your servants have tended livestock from our boyhood on, just as our fathers did. Then you will be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen, for all shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians. So Moses has increased his disgrace in the eyes of the Egyptians by becoming a shepherd. Exactly why they despise shepherds isn't clear. but he becomes someone they detest because he's a keeper of sheep. And while that is a disgrace to the Egyptians, it isn't to God. Think of the places where the Bible speaks positively about shepherds. The famous psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." Or Jesus' words, "I am the good shepherd." But what was disgrace and detestable to the Egyptians, for Moses, he's just back in the family business. Just like you or I might have been a generation or two ago, my father and his father before him were whatever it might be. Now, if you're here this evening and you're not yet a Christian, you might think you've just not made a choice, that you're waiting to make that choice. But really, not making a choice is choosing. You're choosing not to identify with Jesus. And instead, you're choosing the fleeting pleasures of sin. You're choosing the treasures of Egypt. And there's a warning here, isn't there? These things are temporary. And this passage should shout out at you like Moses. Choose what is best. Choose what really lasts. Choose even though there might be temporary difficulties, because the reward is far better. But if we are Christians, the account of Moses reminds us there are choices we still need to make every day. I'm sure most of us will have had that experience of having to choose between two or more puddings after a meal. You weigh up, should you have the cheesecake or should you have the Viennetta? And finally, you ask, can I have a bit of both, please? We've all done it. It's okay. But when we're looking at the choices Moses had to make, can we have a bit of both? No. The choice here is not one we can have a foot in one camp and a foot in the other camp. We're either suffering with the people of God or we're enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin. We're either accepting disgrace for the sake of Christ or we're trying to hold on to the treasures of Egypt. As Christians, we're not immune from the pull of Egypt. We still have the old nature that loves these things, and it's a dying old nature unless we feed it with the treasures of Egypt. So every day as Christians, we're called to choose. Every time we're tempted, we're called to choose to live in the light of the choice we first made when we ran from sin and ran to Jesus Christ as our Saviour and our Lord. Whenever we feel the pull of the treasures of Egypt or the fleeting pleasures of sin, that temptation can express itself in different ways for us, can't it? Different times for different people. Maybe it's what we choose to be entertained by when nobody else is looking. Maybe it's what gives us the most enjoyment in our lives above God. Most satisfaction. Maybe it's what we put our trust in the uncertain world we live in COVID, or as we see the cost of living rising week by week, do we put our trust in the things we can see and hold on to, the treasures of Egypt, instead of what Moses did? It's a curious phrase, the way it's described. It says that Moses persevered because he saw him who is invisible. Can't see people who are invisible or anything that's invisible, can you? But God saw him by faith and trusted in God what he couldn't see, but what he knew was better. So Moses is the real life example of the proverb, better a little with fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. So we'll look now at the last little section, verse 28, when death brings salvation. It says, by faith he kept the Passover and the application of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. So Moses is 80, he's called by God to go back and to be God's instrument to lead the people of Israel out from their life of slavery, out into the promised land. And by faith he kept the Passover. God called them to do this, to take this lamb, to kill it, to put the blood on the doorposts, to eat it with unleavened bread. So maybe as we look back at the people of Israel at that time, it's maybe difficult to get into their minds. Maybe we sort of think they were used to this sort of thing, plagues and what have you. But if you read through from the beginning of the Bible, those extraordinary circumstances were not usual. Most of life was like our life, relatively ordinary most of the time. And so as they've gone from these 70 people who came down with Jacob to be thousands and thousands of people, things have probably changed for them slowly. They go from these despite being despised shepherds living by themselves in the land of Goshen to becoming Pharaoh's slaves. And we find them grumbling and complaining in the wilderness. They forget all the slavery. They look back into the fish and the cucumbers. They give this sort of shopping list, the melons, the leeks, the onions and the garlic. So what do they feel about this deliverance that's apparently coming? Well, after Moses and Aaron go and see Pharaoh for the first time, things take a turn for the worse. Same amount of bricks have to be made, and now they have to get their own straw to make them. And they complain to Moses and Aaron. They say, "You've made us obnoxious to Pharaoh and his officials and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." And Moses complains to God. He says, "Why have you brought this trouble on this people? Why haven't you delivered them like you said you would?" The situation, instead of getting better, has got worse. God says, "Look, remember what I promised Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? Remember, I haven't forgotten you. The promises haven't been forgotten either." So he says, "Tell the people that rescue is coming. Freedom is coming. Freedom from slavery is on its way. There's mighty acts of judgment on the Egyptians coming, and they will have this special relationship. They will be God's people, and he will be their God. And God will bring you to the land he promised to the descendants of Abraham, not to be a foreigner in it like Abraham was, just wandering round, but to have it as a possession." When Moses goes back to the people, it doesn't really help them. They don't listen because they're discouraged, because they're being harshly treated by the Egyptians. That's all they can think about. But 9 plagues later, Moses is still not getting Pharaoh to agree to let the people go. God asks Moses to tell the Israelites to hold the Passover, to kill the lamb, to put the blood on the doorposts. The firstborn of Egypt will be killed, but when God sees the blood, he will pass over. Are the people still grumbling and complaining? It says, "Then the people bowed down and worshipped. The Israelites did just what the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron." These hard-pressed people have come from disbelief to faith. They're trusting in God's promises to deliver them. And they're showing that trust by keeping the Passover. Back into verse 28 in the letter to the Hebrews, what is commended by what they do? By faith he kept the Passover and the application of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. The application of blood, painting on their doorposts to escape the judgment of Egypt, that's what's highlighted as the reason for their deliverance. Now we might ask ourselves, didn't God know where every Israelite lived? Jesus told us that he knows every hair on our head. Did he really need to see the blood so he didn't make a mistake? He didn't really need the blood, did he? But in asking the Israelites to do it, he focuses their mind on deliverance through the blood. When God tells them to keep the first Passover, he also tells them to keep it every year to remember God's deliverance. And while they're keeping it in the wilderness, they're looking forward, because he says, "When you enter the land, the Lord will give you as he promised. Observe this ceremony." So he gives them that looking forward in that time in the wilderness until the time when the promise is fulfilled. The people of Israel were spared. The Egyptians were not. What made the difference? Just the blood. That's all. And that looked forward to an event that would happen hundreds of years later, when one man, the Lord Jesus Christ, experienced the judgment of God so that others might escape. So after regaling us with the faith of all these people in Hebrews chapter 11, the author moves on to encourage us, in the light of what we heard, to do what? To throw off sin that entangles our lives, to run the race with perseverance. I don't know if you've ever been on a really long walk, or a really long run, or a really long bike ride. When the going gets tough, you've still got a long way to go. It can really help to have something to think about, can't it? Whether it's something to divert your mind from your discomfort and your tiredness, or the thought of what you're going to do when you've finally finished. And while we run the race of our lives, this race of perseverance, not a sprint, more of a marathon, the author of Hebrews gives us something to think about. In fact, someone to think about. He says, "Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us." Doing what? Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Here's Jesus. He's chosen, like Moses, the path of unpopularity, the path of conflict with the rulers of this world, the path of unjust punishment, the path of shame to hang on the cross, the shame of the Roman execution that was too bad for Roman citizens to be allowed to experience it, the shame of the Jews who read in the law, "Cursed is everyone who is hung on a pole." And so when we choose to live a life of faith, we're following in some small way, not just the ways of Moses, but the path of Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith, who chose the cross for the joy set before him to redeem people like you and like me. And by focusing our minds often on him who endured all the opposition he did, we will not grow weary and lose heart as we choose to continue to identify with him and to live in the light of that choice.